This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We are in the middle of the Earth's sixth mass extinction. The UK-based Global Challenges Foundation, in a recent report, found that human beings are far more likely to become extinct as a result of climate change than we originally thought. Specifically, it found that, quote, the average American is more than five times likelier to die during a human extinction event than in a car crash. Indeed, there are new reports every day warning against the runaway impacts of climate change and raising our worst fears that perhaps it is already too late to turn back from our production of greenhouse gas emissions. Well, is it really too late? And if so, how do we live with such knowledge? My guest is Guy McPherson. He's a professor emeritus of natural resources and the environment at the University of Arizona, the author of more than a dozen books, including Going Dark and Extinction Dialogues. Welcome to the show, Guy.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to chat today.
So, do you believe it is too late for us to reverse the effects of climate change?
Yes, I believe it is far too late with respect to some species on the planet, including ours, to reverse climate change. We are in the midst of abrupt, irreversible climate change. And at this point, there is nothing we can do to stop runaway climate change.
So can you make your case? I mean, of course, you're not doing a scientific presentation here. You may not have graphs and charts, but to a layperson who might be very skeptical of what you're saying, because we haven't heard other scientists say this, how do you make the case? How do you what reports and hard facts can you point to that this is actually the case?
Right. Well, a lot of people are not making this case, especially in the climate science community. I suspect that's largely because most climate scientists don't have a background in conservation biology. Conservation biologists study speciation and extinction. And I'm a professor emeritus of conservation biology at the University of Arizona. That's what I study. Physicists and astronomers and planetary scientists do not focus on extinction and speciation. I've been focusing on those phenomena for a long time. So that gives me a perspective that is probably different from that of many climate scientists. So the central issue for our species and every other species on the planet is habitat. We are human animals. And sometimes we forget about that last word, the animal part. But as human animals, we depend upon habitat for our own survival. What that means is we depend upon the ability to secure our food and our water and to maintain body temperature within a pretty narrow range of conditions. Without those conditions, we cease to exist. And we're already seeing several million people die each year as a result of climate change. We're already seeing the signposts that we've been warned about along the way, including food and water shortages throughout the planet, including the spread of deadly disease, including heat waves, including superstorms that have the power to level cities and create darkness, and so on. So these are the things that are already behind us that we've been warned about for a long time. Where's it go from here? We've already fired the clathrate gun. Methane is coming out of the Arctic Ocean at an astonishingly rapid pace and has gone exponential in the atmosphere. In addition, moistening the upper troposphere by itself, that increase in water vapor and the ability to trap heat on the planet, those two alone, methane from the Arctic Ocean and moistening the upper troposphere, are sufficient by themselves to create conditions that will make it impossible for humans to persist on the planet. And there are two among more than five dozen self-reinforcing feedback loops, I point out at GuyMcPherson.com.
And so when you talk about reinforcing feedback loops, I mean, essentially, is that what we mean when we think of what's called runaway climate change?
That's exactly right. So it's out of our hands now. It was in 1989, June 29th, in fact, that Associated Press ran a story. So it went in many, many newspapers, June 29th, 1989. The Associated Press interviews the United Nations Environment Program leader from New York, who said we have 10 years to fix the carbon problem, 10 years to fix our emissions of CO2 into the atmosphere. That was June 29th, 1989. If I'm doing the math right, we're just a couple of months shy of 17 years too late to deal with that problem. So we have triggered these self-reinforcing feedback loops or runaway climate change. It's the snowball that you push down the hill, and the further it goes, the bigger it gets. The bigger it gets, the faster it goes, the more power it has behind it.
Right. And so just for our audience, essentially, the idea is that scientists can't predict all of the impacts of climate change because they rely on models. But what we find is that when you have a certain limit that you reach of certain greenhouse gases or any other impacts of climate change, that in turn triggers something that can't be stopped, which basically means that once a certain limit has been reached, it is out of our hands. You're saying that limit had been reached a while ago.
That's right. In fact, the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases in October 1990 said that 1 degree Celsius above baseline, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, roughly 1750, that 1 degree C is the absolute upper limit we could not cross or we'd trigger runaway greenhouse. We're now more than 1.5 degrees above that baseline temperature. David Spratt, climate writer and speaker, said nearly 2 years ago that probably 0.5 degree was the upper limit. That was the Rubicon we could not cross. We hear a lot about 2 degrees C. 2 degrees C is locked in already, and it was never a scientific target, and it was always a political target. That's essentially behind us at this point. So we are already in the realm of dangerous climate change, of people dying in large numbers as a result of runaway climate change. And we're at the beginning of an event that has precedence in planetary history of abrupt climate change, a very rapid global average temperature rise in a very short period of time. And here I'm talking months and years, not decades.
So are you the only one who's making such assertions? I mean, we know like scientists like James Hansen, who's one of the leading figures among climate scientists, also a very serious activist, has been on the front lines of climate protests, gotten arrested. Is he saying the same sorts of things you're saying?
No, as an astronomer and physicist, that's what his degrees
right.
are. I suspect he doesn't appreciate the biological aspects and the ecological aspects that I'm referring to. So he has done great work. In his 2007 book, he was particularly concerned. The book is called Storms of My Grandchildren. He was particularly concerned about firing the clathrate gun. That book came out in 2007. It appears that that's the year that the clathrate gun was fired, that methane started leaking out of the Arctic Ocean at an accelerating pace. Now he doesn't talk about the clathrate gun much anymore, and I don't know why that is, but I'm not the only person. There are more than a dozen of people, including other biologists, who have indicated we don't have long, that our time as a species here is just about over, and that it is irreversible and there's nothing we can do.
Now, you have come under criticism from working climate scientists who say that you are wildly distorting the science, that you have, in a way, here, let me quote this, gained a cultishly persistent following in the deep ecology / doomer fringe of the hard green movement. So you're being painted, at least by some people, as an extreme radical on this issue.
Right. I would say I am a radical. Radical means to get to the root. I would also argue that I am taking a more extreme view than almost anybody else because I understand conservation biology. In addition,
but I mean, you can't be the only one understanding conservation biology. There must be other conservation biologists who do.
You're absolutely right about that, and I suspect they're all paid. And that's a huge difference. I walked away from a paycheck 7 years and 2 days ago.
You're suggesting that conservation biologists are paid off to not speak out about the extreme effects of climate change?
No, I'm not suggesting they're paid off to not speak out. I'm suggesting that they are discouraged from speaking out, as I was during my entire tenure as a professor in active service at the University of Arizona. Speaking out brings you great animus and great resistance from the people who write you paychecks becomes a difficult situation, to say the least. I'm not saying people are being paid off. I'm saying that when people speak out and say the kinds of things I say, that they are subject to resistance at the very least and outright oppression in some cases. So speaking the the full truth, the full story, exposing the full evidence about climate change is not a comfortable position for people who are in positions of comfort. And I guarantee that if you're a person who looks a lot like me, who's a white male and well paid at university or government position, you're in a position of privilege. You're in a position of comfort. And that comfort can be taken away, can be challenged, can be snatched away on a moment's notice if you are willing to expose the kind of evidence that I'm willing to expose.
Well, can you give us some examples or instances of your own personal experience when you were discouraged as a practicing professor to not reveal the full extent of your research?
Sure. I was libeled by my own dean at the University of Arizona on the pages of the daily newspaper in Tucson, Arizona. My final department head was hired specifically to make my life miserable enough that I would leave.
And it was specifically related to your work on climate change?
It was specifically related to my work, which included more than climate change at the time and still does. I was and am a social critic, so I write about various aspects of the set of living arrangements, not merely climate change. Climate change is a symptom of industrial civilization. There are other symptoms too, such as driving to extinction 150 to 200 species a day. That's from the United Nations report in August of 2010, such as fouling the air and dirtying the water. And when you start talking about these things, it attracts the attention of the administration of an organization that depends upon economic growth for its own survival.
So it isn't too much of a stretch, of course, to understand that human beings as a species are going extinct, given that, as I mentioned, we are in the middle of the sixth mass extinction. This is something that scientists do have a consensus on. Certainly our actions, and as people, you know, call it anthropogenic climate change, is resulting in the extinction of other species at an astonishing rate. However, of course, we'd like to think we're different. We have the brains to adapt to climate change, that we have the technology, that we can innovate ourselves, our ways out of this in a way that, of course, other species can't, or that we, you know, won't help other species too, because we're a selfish species. So, you know, how much of that sort of exceptional thinking might be to our downfall?
Yeah, you know, I was featured in an episode of National Geographic with Bill Nye, the science guy, last fall. I think it came out November 1st. And the episode focused and was derived from my work and focused on Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief. And they went through the five stages of grief, beginning with denial and anger and depression, and then all the way through acceptance. And then they reverted back to bargaining, back to stage three, and started talking about how we're going to tech our way out of this. Well, it was tech that got us into this mess. Civilization is a heat engine, as pointed out by at least three papers by Tim Garrett, atmospheric scientist at the University of Utah. Civilization itself is a heat engine, and the suggestion that we need to turn off the heat engine challenges those who benefit most from the heat engine being kept on. And that's those of us who enjoy this enormous privilege of having the water come through the taps and the oil show up at the gas station, the gasoline show up at the gas station, the food show up at the grocery store, and so on. So naturally, challenging that narrative is a relatively thankless task.
Well, Guy, is there some benefit that scientists see in not letting the public know that we are past the point of, you know, of reversal? I mean, is there the sense that if the public really knew that we were past, you know, that it was too late on climate change, that humanity would throw its hands up in the air and say, all right, let's just live like we're gonna die tomorrow?
You know, I don't know. I don't know what's in the heads of other scientists, certainly not other climate scientists. I suspect politicians are, and the media are not exposing the complete information for the most part, because they would anticipate chaos in the presence of this information. I don't know that we have the information to reach that conclusion, by the way. I suspect that instead, when things get tough, and we in the privileged global north are exposed to the kind of horrors that are already affecting people in the Middle East and Northern Africa and small island states in the Pacific. They're losing habitat already. When we're exposed to that kind of thing, I suspect that some people will become more compassionate, more kind, and more creative than they already are. And that others, of course, might become worse individuals than they are now. But we don't know that, you know, and as a natural scientist, I'm not in a position to predict how individuals are going to act. I can barely predict how I'm going to act, much less how others are going to.
So let's get into a little bit of the detail. If we talk about the potential extinction, or perhaps a certain extinction of the human race, what do we mean by that? Are we talking about losing a certain percentage of the entire population, you know, through various impacts of climate change, or are we talking about a disappearance of our species?
Yes, both. Already, 5 million people die each year as a result of climate change. That report is from a few years ago and does not include consequences of the abrupt climate change that is underway now. Ultimately, all species go extinct. All. There are no exceptions. Ultimately, all individuals die. As organisms, we are born, we show up on the planet, we blink three times, and then we're dead. So it shouldn't be any surprise to any listener out there that everybody dies and that every species goes extinct as well. The timing in this case is the only question remaining for us. We are in the midst of the sixth great extinction. Obviously, all individuals die and all species go extinct. When is it our turn? Well, of course, we can't predict that with accuracy. I don't know when your expiration date is. I don't know when the expiration date is for our entire species. But I am certain that it will be sooner than expected by almost everybody on this planet. Ultimately, we will run out of habitat. We're already on the way. There are many places around the globe that have already run out of habitat. And that's why we have a refugee crisis that has now gone global. I believe it was 3 days ago, Sally Jewell, Secretary of the Department of Interior of the United States, said, and I quote, "There will be we will have refugees." She was talking about the United States. We will have refugees. That's exactly right, because we already do.
Meaning we Americans will become refugees?
We will experience a refugee crisis on our own shores.
Mm. Well, we are already, of course, Latin America.
Absolutely. So, what I'm saying is, by the time the government gets around to telling us that there is a refugee crisis on the way, it's already here. It's already underway.
Now, there are scientists who study past mass extinctions. They look at the fossil record. They try to study how certain animals adapted in the face of disaster. And often the way in which this is framed in public media or in mainstream media is that these scientists are trying to figure out how we as a species might be able to adapt to a changing environment by looking at how, you know, say, for example, birds survived when their ancestors, the dinosaurs, didn't. Is that a fruitless task?
Well, I'm not in a position of telling anybody what is a fruitless task. I think people should do what they love, and they should pursue excellence in whatever they do, no matter how long we have left on the planet. Will that prevent our would greatly surprise me. Are we going to be able to geoengineer our own bodies, much less the whole planet, to give us a while longer on the planet? It would very much surprise me. But hey, if that's what you love to do, if that's what you're really good at, and that's what you determine defines a life of excellence for you, then as Socrates said, or as Plato channeling Socrates said, go for it.
As a conservational biologist, would you be interested in pursuing such science, knowing what you know?
No, I wouldn't. For me, that's like saying we're going to persist by living in nuclear submarines or eating Soylent Green or somehow changing ourselves into non-human beings. And I'm not interested. I'm interested in being a human being.
What do you make of some sort of blanket pronouncements by activists, climate activists, who really want to find a panacea for the climate crisis? I mean, we often hear people say, if everybody on the planet were vegan, we would solve the climate crisis in an instant.
Sure, and I receive those kinds of one trick pony solutions on a pretty regular basis. But becoming vegan or looking to aliens from space or any number of other propositions that I've received will
You've
not.
received propositions about looking to aliens from space?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's always something that's going to save us.
Okay.
And if it's not ourselves, then it must be something beyond us, some paranormal phenomena. And my response to those is always the same. You know, it was human behavior within civilization that got us into this mess. And so maintaining civilization in whatever form, it seems very unlikely to get us out of this mess. So let's acknowledge that our lives are short and that that applies as at the level of a species, as well as at individuals, and let's pursue excellence in whatever form we can in the short time that we're here.
And well,
Recognize.
to some people, that might mean using as much energy as they can because, maybe, someone who doesn't have children and doesn't care about the future. I mean, I don't know, is that really something that we should be recommending?
Lest we paint everybody who doesn't have children with a broad brush.
You're right. Take that back.
I don't have children, and I'm far more concerned about the future than I think most people I know. People tell me all the time that adopting my message to actually integrating into people's lives will cause them to become hedonists. And I say, Americans become hedonists? Really? When is that going to happen again? Oh, wait, we have the world's reserve currency. We do whatever we want. We have for pretty much my entire life.
Hedonism has gotten us here.
Exactly. And so am I worried about a few people becoming more hedonist-like in their behavior? Well, not particularly, because I think anybody who truly groks my message, who truly understands what I'm trying to say, is not going to buy more toys, is not going to start t checking things off their bucket list, but rather will live with compassion and courage and creativity and maybe start spending time with those they love, recognizing that those people aren't going to be around forever either.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how not to be utterly depressed by what you're saying. I mean, there's plenty of people who feel like, in addition to attending climate protests, agitating the government, pouring money into renewable energies, we also sort of try to change our own lifestyle, installing solar panels on our roofs, installing a gray water system, trying to learn how to grow our own food and create small ecosystems so that we can survive. What do you make of those?
You're talking about the things I've already done. Nobody has a bigger reason to be wrong than I do, because I did all that. I left active service at the university. I haven't received a paycheck for 7 years. I created a homestead, which is heated by a passive solar. I have composting toilets and a gray water system. I learned how to grow all of my own food. I did all that. I recognize that even if we all did that tomorrow, and there's not enough room on the planet for us to do that tomorrow, for all of us, for 7.3 billion of us, and probably not even for a couple hundred million of us, it still will not unfire the clathrate gun. It still will not stop the self-reinforcing feedback loop that is moistening the upper troposphere. And the same for the other 60-some self-reinforcing feedback loops I've identified. There's no stopping the runaway train at this point. It's a runaway train. It's not only a runaway train, it already fell off the trestle. What we're talking about now is figuring out who gets the best view on the way down and who's going to take the actions to make people to comfort the afflicted as we head for the big crash.
So, I mean, what about efforts to transition away from fossil fuels to renewable energies? Are those worth it?
I'm a huge fan. That's what I did between 6 and 10 years ago in establishing the homestead I live on. If that's what people, if that's what you love, if you really love doing that, if for you that represents the pursuit of excellence, then please, by all means, do that. I think that's a great idea. In addition, inspired by a Buddhist perspective, I believe we should take right action, and I think that's right action. independent of the outcome. I don't think it's going to turn out well, but I still think we should treat people decently, even if we don't expect them to treat us decently back. I think we should treat the planet with decency and with respect, even though I suspect at this point it won't matter. So let's do all those things that we think are right from a moral perspective, from an ethical perspective, regardless of how this turns out.
So Guy McPherson, you're on a speaking tour right now. Last year I saw that you toured Europe. What's your message to audiences? Essentially live your lives with compassion and just put your best selves forward and understand that this is the beginning of the end?
That's a big part of it, yes. To recognize that you were never guaranteed another day. Mm. You were never guaranteed another year. Live here now. If I were to compress my message into three words, those would be the three. Live here now. And maybe recognize that our run on the planet, the 200,000 years our species has been here, is the blink of a cosmic eye when viewed from the perspective of a 13.8 billion year-old universe. So maybe the whole thing of humans on Earth, maybe the whole universe wasn't actually constructed for us, given that we were not here for 99.9% of the time that the universe has been here. So maybe live with a little humility in light of that fact.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Guy McPherson. Would you like to give out any websites?
Yes, a couple of plugs. You can find where I'm going to be speaking within the next 2 weeks. You can find that information at guymcpherson.com at the coming events tab up there on top of the page, or guymcphersontours.com. So either one of those places will have you hooking up with me in Chico and Monterey and all the way down to Encinita by way of Ojai and Beverly Hills.
And we'll post details on our website. Thanks so much.
That'd be awesome. Thank you very much.
My guest is Guy McPherson. He's a professor emeritus of natural resources and the environment at the University of Arizona, author of more than a dozen books, including Going Dark and Extinction Dialogues. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter and listen to our stories on iTunes or watch them on Vimeo.